The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports columnists.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody wants everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Well, hello, and thanks for joining us on another episode of the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we have a two-parter. First, we'll speak to an American playwright, screenwriter, director, and prominent television producer. He is best known for his work on Law & Order Criminal Intent, Lights Out, and then he became the showrunner for In Treatment and Law & Order Special Victims Unit. His play, Sideman, was a finalist for the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. He is Warren Light. And then we will turn to the NFL with this discussion with our favorite information man, the one and only Adam Schefter. But before we get started with Warren and Adam, I want to tell you about Geico. There's a quick way you could save money to switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. And he was a showrunner and ran the show. He picked up a hit show and continued it until I think he stopped in 2016. His name is Warren Light, and I am delighted to have him on today.
Pretty nice to be here. Thanks.
And in addition to everything
dirty
else,
secret that show. It's everybody's.
It's not a
pleasure, right?
No. It's a guilty. I don't even. It's so good that I can't call it a guilty pleasure. And I'm constantly sending you messages because I'll see an episode that I had never seen before, like the one where they killed off poor Andy Carl. And it's just is it 20th year, Warren?
They're in season 20 now. I'm almost positive they'll get picked up for season 21. There's an annual dance with the network, but I think it would be folly not to pick them up for next year. So.
And they have now. Are they about to tie the original Law and Order for a length of time on the air?
Yeah, I think that they're about to hit or may have just hit episode 450, and I think that. In terms of episodes, they may be passing them. The key stat in all of this is the 21st season is the record season, which I think passes Gunsmoke. 20th was Law and Order, and Law and Order was unceremoniously pulled just shy of the record. It's like benching some guy who's hit, you know, who's hitting 399. You know, just like let him get. But that was another era in the. The network game. Anyway, they should get the record next year for longest running drama, and Mariska is, a force of nature. So I think she's the LeBron of that. She carries that show on her back. You know,
no matter
what showrunner she's stuck with, me or whoever else, she'll get you to the finals. You know,
it's funny, Warren. The frame of reference I always use for someone as completely essential, but part of an ensemble as she is with Law and Order SVU. I call it Hawkeye Pierce. Okay. Because as great as MASH was and as brilliant as Larry Gelbart was in taking it from the movies and putting it on TV and as much, you know, player movement as they had, the one guy they could not lose was Alan Alda, and the one person they can't lose off of Law & Order SVU is Mariska Hargitay.
I couldn't agree more. When I came in, it was a day after Maloney's contract talks had fallen apart, and there was this sense of the show was we're done. And the crew looked at me, they didn't, you know, who's the new guy? And, yeah. And basically everyone was like, boss, just get us through to Christmas. And I thought, because up until that moment, it was season 12, first 12 years, Chris was number one on the call sheet. And he's a force, but I think they underestimated what she could do, and So in my first season, she became officially number one on the call sheet, and I just I just kept calling plays for her.
Obviously, the franchise is something that will, you know, be part of the history of this time in television and everything that Dick Wolf has done and continues to do. But what to what do you attribute the appeal of this show? Because there's a lot of other shows that last, but the subject matter week after week, month after month, year to year is so rough.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't think people would watch if they, if again, I'll go back to Mariska or Olivia, right? I think that, first of all, it is a sign of, when the whole Me Too movement erupted and people were shocked by how many people were coming forward with stories. I wasn't shocked at all because I know from running that show and from the fans and the interactions you have with people, how widespread sexual abuse, sexual assault is in our society, and how much of it is swept under covers, and how much of it is kept in the dark, and how much. Well, you saw yesterday a senator came forward and said when she was in the Air Force she was raped.
Yep.
She never.
Martha McSally, so, yeah.
It's day after day of these incidents, and I think a large part of the audience watches the show because this is how they wish their abuse or assault had been handled. So I was surprised by the number of survivors in the audience, or relatives of survivors, or people who've been affected by this in one way or another. And it just, before I joined the show, I thought, maybe the show has survived because there's something slightly salacious about this, or it's somehow appealing to people for the wrong reasons. But it turned out to be the exact opposite. It's almost cathartic for a lot of the audience. And then the other trick of it is it's one story for an hour. Justice is often done, but not always done. But the cops are heroic. They're flawed, but they're heroic. They want to do the right thing. They want to get the bad guys. They're empathic. You have a range of scenes you can write. It's a seemingly tight structure, but boy, I found a lot of variations within it. And unfortunately, every day another, two dozen stories break that you can combine and get something interesting out of, and appalling out of, and disturbing out of, and moving out of. But I think the focus, because Olivia's focus is also on the victim, I think that's something a little different than a lot of crime shows. A lot of the other shows are more clinical or more graphic or more are flashier. We never had chase scenes, really. Nobody in that cast could run. it's not about shoot 'em ups or anything like that. It's just legwork and emotion. That's what I came to understand over 117 episodes.
We're talking to Warren Light on the Mike Lupica podcast. And, what's wonderful is that, New York City is part of the cast of the show. I have one funny Law and Order story, but it's the original Law and Order, not Law and Order SVU. And I had gotten to know Jerry Orbach, the late, great Jerry Orbach. And, in fact, he used to send me by mail possible one-liners for my Sunday column, which I'd always use. I don't in the daily news. And so one day I was appearing on Good Morning America in those days, and I'm walking back to my apartment, and I'm cutting through Lincoln Center, and I see Jerry sitting in a car, and I say, "Hey, Jerry," and he leans out the window and he says, "Hey, Mike," and the next thing I hear is cut, 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 cut. And people came running from all, and I felt that I was going to be arrested on Law and Order.
That's great. Oh, he was a lovely guy, and
oh boy,
that's one of the things I liked. That there's a whole fear of shooting in New York that goes back decades, but everyone's comfortable when it's an SVU shooting their neighborhood, although nobody likes losing a parking space. But other than that, they feel like they know everybody in the cast, and it's that's probably the 100th time someone came up to him in the middle of a scene. At least he knew your name.
He was so approachable and available. You know, a lot of guys end up being showrunners in television, and it's but now at this time when there's 57,000 shows that seem to be shooting all the time. But how does a playwright, and not just a playwright, but somebody who's played Sideman, which was kind of not completely, but a love letter to your jazz man father. How did you make that transition?
I wish I could say I made it, but it's really true for my career. Things happen. I used to call it the toxic waste theory of my career, that something dribbles out and shows up. And I had Sideman, which changed my life and was kind of a relief to get acknowledgement. I've been really banging my head against the wall for 20 years trying to get plays up, get a production. I'd have 100 readings a year, but productions were hard to come by. It's just so much easier to bring a play in from London than try an untested playwright out in New York. So Sideman changed my life, but then I hit a tough patch where I was coping with a lot of elder care of both my mother and my father and my father's twin, and I was, despite having had a hit play, I was hemorrhaging money, and I ran into fellow playwright and TV writer Teresa Rebeck on the street, and she said, I watched her, she saw I was under duress, and she said, I'm on a show that may want one more New York writer. It's called Criminal Intent. I didn't know a thing about it. I didn't know that it shot here. I didn't know that Law and Order had more than one show. I didn't know it was.
Yeah.
And I just said, yeah, that sounds great. I think because I had the Tony for Sideman, that made me slightly interesting to the showrunner, Rene Bossé. I stayed up all night. I watched every episode they had done. They were starting their second season. I read every script, and I didn't know what you do for a TV interview. And I stayed up and I plotted out a 5-act episode. I looked at their shows. I saw it's 5 acts. There's a teaser that's kind of weird, and so I thought I have to come in with that before I meet him. It's 20 years later, no one's ever done that for me. It doesn't. But
yeah.
I overcompensated, and I went in and I met with him, and I'd been waiting to hear about a couple other jobs. David Chase kept saying he might hire me for The Sopranos, and Rene pretty much hired me on the spot. And I didn't even understand how TV worked. They said you'll get $12,000 an episode. I thought that's nice to write an episode. What they meant was you get $12,000 for every episode made in the year, whether or not you work on it. That's what it means to be on staff. And I had no idea what this was about. I got in there, and it turned out I was well suited to it because it's deadline writing, and I'd always been a binge writer. And there's a lot, and when you've been doing a lot of low budget one act theater and stuff, you work with the costume designer, the set designer, you work with actors all the time. You're sometimes hanging lights yourself, so you know how things get produced. And I'd been on the fringes of the film world, so I'd been on sets, and I just kind of fell into it, and the first script went over well, and then they just kept throwing stuff at me. I found TV for me to be an easier, I've been banging my head against the wall in theater for 20 years. I wasn't part of the right clubs, it felt like to me. And in TV, if you hand in a script on time, and don't whine too much, they'll toss you another. And they kept tossing me more. And 4 years later, when Rene left, I met Dick Wolf for the first time. And it was a very odd interview. I didn't know that Rene was leaving. And he said, everyone says you're a nice guy. And I said, I try to be. He goes, well, you can't be a nice guy if you're going to be the showrunner. I said, I don't know. I guess there's different ways of managing people. And it goes on like this for 5 minutes. And finally I said, I'm sorry, what are we talking about? And he said, well, Rene's deal, it didn't work out. But if you're going to be the showrunner, you can't be a nice guy. And I said, well, okay. If you're asking me, do I want the shot? I'll take the shot. And he goes, that's all I need to hear. And that was the job interview.
It's amazing how I talk about sports all the time and how the biggest stories turn on the smallest moments. Okay. And I got from the Miracle on Ice team, I was talking to Ruzioni the other day about Mark Johnson scores a goal with 1 second left in the first period. Now it's 2-2 and it's not the game. It was, you know, you go through history, but those random moments, when I first moved to New York, I was hired by the old New York Post and wrote four stories the first week. I'm 23 years old. Okay, I'm just happy to be there. I go in and look at my schedule for the next week. And the sports editor was this Runyon-esque character named Mike Ellis. And I look at my schedule, and the Knicks are opening the season. And it's Knicks game story, a sidebar. Da, 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 da. And I said, I went back to his office. I was scared to death. I said, Mr. Gellis, I can't help but notice you have me covering the Knicks next week. And he goes, yeah. And I said, I thought Lenny Lewin covered the Knicks. And he said, not anymore. And he went back to his phone call with his bookie. And in that moment, you know, my life changed. And literally, it had never come up when I was hired that this was 2 weeks later I'd be covering the Knicks.
No, it was pure chance that I ran into Risa. It was pure chance they were looking for somebody. And I had read a lot of Sherlock Holmes, which is kind of what Criminal Intent was. So I was a New York guy, and they needed a New York guy. And then Renee's deal, it was, isn't Renee the show owner? Not anymore. You know, his deal had blown up. Every once in a while, a deal blows up. And I was, I still don't know who told Dick I was the guy. I have some suspicions. But it's very odd how it worked. And then I was in completely over my head. But I think the truth about show running is you can either do it or you can't. And, I'd grown up, as the play details, with a constant amount of chaos in my life, and it was my job during the chaos to be the one who keeps the lid on it and keeps it calm and gets everybody back to normal. And there was a great need for that on the set of Criminal Intent, and there was, deadlines are not scary. I kind of need the deadline to get the work done, so suddenly procrastination wasn't a problem, because I'm a little bit of I have that child of an alcoholic people pleaser pig, right? So I can't keep 200 people waiting for a script. That would be rude. So I'll stay up all night. So it kind of weirdly felt right, and I understood the different departments, and I understood how to give people attaboys, which make a lot of difference. It turns out there are different ways to manage a show, and my style was very different from my predecessors, but his worked. And then mine after his came as something of a relief to everybody, because it was a little less dogmatic, I'd say. So, once you do it, I think you're in. It hinged on improbable. It hinges on running into people on a street.
Warren Light is our guest on the Mike Lupica podcast. Much more with Warren right after this from our friends at Kronos. Okay, it's day one for a new employee. But instead of joining in productively, they face a confusing, disjointed process, piles of paper forms. With Kronos, you can automate the entire onboarding process, creating a better experience for employees and freeing you to focus on the human part of your job. HR, payroll, talent, timekeeping in one unified system, all with proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at Kronos.com/onboarding. Kronos, workforce innovation that actually works. You know, and the charm of this show is you reference Christopher Maloney leaves and Dan Florek leaves, but you turn it on now. And you look at the core group now, built obviously around Marishka and Kelly Giddish and Peter Scannavino and Ice-T, and you just feel as if they've been together forever. That, like, oh, okay, this has been the show, but it hasn't been the show for 20 years. But again, when you've got her at point guard, it somehow seems to make everything work easier.
No, every once in a while I look at a picture of the season 12 team, the season 6 team, and all those photos are up there in the office. And, you forget it was 11 people at one time, but the one constant is Marishka. And by the way, you know, Kelly, I brought in because I had done an episode with her in Criminal Intent, and she and it had stayed with me. Peter had done an episode of Criminal Intent, it had stayed with me. So Scannavino, and you know, it's so I kind of pulled people I knew would fit into this world. But the reason they feel so cohesive is I think because of what happens on the set. They're spending it's a long, you know, it's not hard labor, but it's 13 hours a day. 5 days a week, or 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, they're with each other all the time. Right. And they do become, as actors, a cohesive team. They take care of each other, they look out for each other, you know each other's lives. And that comes through. And luckily, one of the things I really try hard for is to have what I call an asshole-free zone. You just can't act out on the set. You can't come in unprepared. You can't come in with an attitude. Mariska sets that tone, too. And so it's a bunch of decent people working really hard to get it right who are grateful to be where they are at the moment. And that's a good team. And I think a lot of my task then is to see what's happening with them interpersonally as actors and then write that for their characters, which kind of pisses them off sometimes, but I think it's a good thing to do. They go, man, remind me not to talk around you anymore. But if you see something in practice, you put it in the game, you know. Use what's going on if there's a little tension one day between two actors, I'll write it into a scene, and then they'll all get mad at me, but the scene will play, and then there's less tension between them, you know.
You know, Bobby Valentine once told me when Mike Piazza was his best player, when your best player is also a good guy, it filters down through the other 24. And after my pal Bill Goldman died, we had a memorial service for him at the Ziegfeld Theater. That was just one of the great days, one of the great celebrations of all time. And Rob Reiner was talking about The Princess Bride, the shooting of the movie. And he said everybody liked each other. And, you know, they were over in England, and he said it was just one of those magical experiences where you knew you were doing good work. You know, everybody felt what was happening, but and then at night, everybody kind of hang around together because they were there. And it just, you know, he said sometimes it doesn't click, but that one it did.
Yeah, it's weird. I've been on sets where everyone likes each other and it still doesn't click, but it helps a lot. It helps a lot. It helps to be out of town. We did Sideman. The first production of it was in Poughkeepsie over the summer up at Vassar. New York Stage and Film has a program up there. And it was, you know, me and a bunch of Schmendrick actors and a good director who hadn't gotten his due at all yet. But there was nothing to do in Poughkeepsie except work on the play. You know, there was one bar. You'd go there at night. You'd have two beers. And it was pre-cell phones, and people were not as distracted as they can be now. And something happened in the 3 weeks of rehearsing in an unair-conditioned gym up there that changed everyone's life in that room. And it was, but it was there was an absence of attitude. Anyone who had an idea about anything was allowed to throw it in. And there wasn't much else to do, and everyone was just trying to make this work together. And I knew at the time I might never have an experience like that again. I was a little surprised to come close to it at SVU, which when I went back to it, people were like, oh, you're going back to a network job. One of the things I thought I would just go in for a year, I stayed 5 years because it was just a nice place to be every day. And you felt like you were doing good work and saying something important. And nobody was there were other sets that we called toxic sets, where the number one on the call sheet is a monster, or there's a bad producing director or a bad showrunner or just some bad juju. And it's a nightmare. You're walalking on eggshells, and it saps you. And a good set does the opposite.
You know, one of my favorite show business stories, I think somebody once asked Henry Fonda what was the most exciting thing that ever happened to him in his career. And he said the first table read of Mr. Roberts on Broadway.
Yeah,
and he said that they got through it, and everybody knew, you know, that they were in the presence of greatness. You know, I sent you not long ago, and I can't remember whether you were still with SVU, but one of the greatest hours I ever saw on television was the episode where they killed off Mike Dodds, played by... Yeah. Were you still...
That was my last episode. I wanted to...
Holy crap. It's one of the best... I don't know how I missed it, but I had. And I saw it a few weeks ago, and it's just, you know, Andy Carl, who's got his own Broadway thing, had become part of the ensemble, and he gets killed off in this episode. It's just one of the great hours I've ever seen in network episodic television.
I was so proud of it. I'd been there 5 years, and I wanted to go out with a strong episode, and I knew Andy was leaving to do a musical. I couldn't guarantee, since I was leaving, I couldn't guarantee Andy a job either after his music. I couldn't control, you want to take care of everybody on your way out, and there was, but those are decisions above my pay grade. And I knew I couldn't protect him. He was still sort of what was called a recurring character, and it didn't look like he was a lock to keep to come back, and they had a nice offer to do Groundhog Day, and so I asked him about it. I don't like killing off characters.
Despite your godlike tendencies, you just at the end of the day, you just don't like.
I had never done it to a regular. I had never. I'd like to leave the door open. It seems kind of final. I mean, or if you're going to do it, you might do it because somebody's driving you crazy. But Andy's like one of the sweethearts of the Western world, and he'd really come into his own on the show. But it made sense to me. He was leaving. You know, he was his father's son. Peter Gallagher plays his dad, and he's doing everything he can to move up the ranks like his dad did, and to prove himself to his dad. And sometimes when you're not living your life for yourself, you're living it for someone else, or to prove something to someone else, you get just a little out of sync. Again, it's the opposite of that one moment that changes. It's that one moment that changes your life,
right?
But in a bad way. And I just wanted to play with the destiny of it, of a guy last day going in on a domestic dispute. I also was very lucky. We had Brad Garrett in that episode. Who's just great. And people.
Oh, my God. Oh, he was just the worst guy ever. Just the worst guy ever.
Just so. He was wonderful on set, but the minute the cameras were rolling, he would do something horrible in a take, just something that made you loathe him. And I go, where did that come from? He goes, too much. I go, no, really good. You know, but he was tuned into it. And I think, you know, again, I was leaving. I think it was very emotional. What's going on behind the scenes is what comes through on camera. Andy was leaving. I was leaving. Lots of transitions coming. People are pretty emotional at the end of the season. You're all exhausted. And all of that comes through. And it was a tough story. And we had Bobby Burke in that episode. So when it came time for the funeral scene, Bobby's a volunteer fireman. He's a kind of a made guy in New York, and he's a beautiful actor, but he's also he knows cops, he knows firemen, and he just understood the decorum of the funeral scene and the lack of decorum of the wake scene at the end of it, and sort of, so it's good to have a little authenticity in those scenes, so you're not just kind of guessing what it's like, and something just happened there. That was another one. I just thought, okay, I can leave now. I'm not going to top this.
No.
I miss it from time to time, but it was, you know, that last episode is tough for a lot of showrunners. You've seen people knock it out of the park, and you've seen people just kind of whiff. It's a complicated thing.
All right, I'm talking to Warren Light, who I've been lucky enough to do a whole bunch of things as a writer in my life, but writing a play is not been one of them. So not only am I envious that he's a playwright, but he won the Tony for best play. All right, he's getting ready to do Commerce today. So, but before we leave, I must tell you that we follow each other on Twitter. That's how this relationship began, and I'm stunned that you're still watching Knicks games on television.
reference
something. They'll be playing like Memphis, and I'm thinking, he's got to have something better to be doing than watching the Knicks play.
It is. I can't really. I mean, there's no. It's a drug, right? It's a horrible drug that leaves you feeling worse, and you no longer get high off of it, but you can't let it go. I'm codependent with them. But this is. I'll say, if anyone's ever been in a bad relationship, right, that you've stayed in too long, just hypothetically, inevitably, I'll talk to people, or I look at some of the ones where both of us could have done better, and it's usually at the start of the relationship there was like one great week or one great night or one great something. Right. Where something happened and you felt more alive than you'd felt in a long time. And what happens is that's that first rush, and then you're hooked. And then it takes a real long time to pull away from it, because there's always the hope that you'll get. So the reason I'm babbling about this is the first year I followed basketball in my life was 1969 and the Knicks.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I get it. No, my son Christopher, my oldest son, grew up backstage with me in the 90s at Madison Square Garden, yeah, which were as close to the glory years, even though they never won a championship, as the glory years. So he's the same as you. He still cares because that keeps pulling him in.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, and I listened on radio in those days. Not all the games weren't all television, you know. No. And there were people. I would call people, and we'd listen on radio together. And it was a great team. Part of my attraction. I still love the Clyde broadcasts after all these years.
Oh yeah.
And you know,
Breen is just so great. I mean, Breen is off the hook great.
Yeah. No. They're good together. And I don't know. You know, okay, it's bad enough that I'm sitting home, after the kids have gone to sleep, and I'm watching it as a way to unwind. But those poor guys have to do it's year after year. And they've kept up their end of the bargain, even after team has failed. I believe the teams have failed them miserably, but they managed to. They're professionals, man. And so I don't know. I like the little things about it. I guess it's a distraction, but it's. I do no college football. I do no professional football. I'll follow the Mets.
Keith and Ron and Gary Cohen do the same thing on those broadcasts, no matter what the Mets are doing on the field, that Mike and Clyde do on the basketball.
Yeah. And in a weird way, that thing of it is a little bit of a metaphor about life when those guys are broadcasting, because they see a bigger picture. I don't know, Clyde is wise, a wise man, you know, and he understands. I love when he talks about the neophyte and he understands the dilemmas of the rookie and someone at the end of their days. And I guess there's also, isn't there that thing of the moment I stop watching, what if I
They'll
miss?
They'll get good. It's, yeah, no, it's like season tickets. It's like season tickets, Jets fans. You know that we're doing this twice a week now. We did not even discuss Trump today. I beseech you to go make yourself a deal and some money. But I think that I would love if we can do this from time to time, because I love talking to you.
I'd be thrilled. I will also say I admired your writing enormously over the years. It was another way I kept engaged with some of these teams that will break your hearts. Anytime, anywhere. Thanks so much.
And part of the fun of doing this podcast for Tyler Brewer, my producer, and me is the range of guests we have. And usually the range goes from podcast to podcast, but today it's two guests in the same podcast. Warren Light talking about Law & Order SVU, and Adam Schefter, my pal from ESPN, is going to talk about Law & Order NFL. And Adam's coming up. We are joined by one of my dearest friends in the business, and one whose success has been particularly heartwarming to those who did the Sports Reporters on television. We now continue it as a podcast for Compass, as a matter of fact. And that is Adam Schefter, who has become the most well-known. You know, Adam, when I say inside man, it sounds like a bank robbery is about to happen. You know what I'm saying?
We've been involved in a couple of those, Michael. You know, we've done our best to try to arrange inside jobs there. And I appreciate your kind words, and it's always heartfelt and gratifying to hear somebody that I always have had so much respect for and always looked up to speaking that way. And it's always meaningful to me to say anything like that. And I really mean that.
And Adam wrote, if you have not read The Man I Never Knew, his book about his wife, her first husband who died on 9/11, I urge you to read it because it is one of the most, Adam, I told you at the time, yeah. And you know, you saw what I said about it. I actually would slow myself down because, you know, even knowing how the book ended, I didn't want it to end because I wanted to make sure that I was appreciating the humanity of this story.
Well, that's very kind of you, Michael, and I appreciate that. And the responses from people have made it very fulfilling and gratifying and humbling to hear. And I know you've sold a ton of books. The book business is a tough business, but I didn't do that.
Oh, gee, Adam, I hadn't picked up on that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Well, there aren't many people who sold more books than you, Mike. You know, and so...
No, Mitch does. Again, no, Adam, let Mitch, me tell you something.
Yes,
Mitch does.
Yes, I know. Yeah. Well, we know that. Okay, that's a given, Mike. But it's, again, the book has done fine, in, you know, sales-wise, but the reaction to it, the response to it is
oh, my God.
Better than the sales of the actual book, if that makes any sense to you.
So, did I say Man I Never Knew? It's The Man I Never Met, obviously. Ed, we're talking to Adam Schefter. Okay, so much going on with football. Let's start with, do you believe Nick Foles is going to end up with the Jaguars?
Mike, that's a great first question from you, and I'll say this to you. I would say that that's the likely but not definite landing spot for him. And in fact, I've spoken to people in the last 24 hours, and we're taping this Thursday, roughly 11 Eastern, and they have told me that that is not a done deal. By the way, if it was a done deal now, and that's not to say it won't get done next week, okay?
Yeah.
But if it was a done deal now, why has Jacksonville not gotten rid of Blake Bortles yet? And so I can also tell you this. I think there are people in that building who believe that they would be better off going with Teddy Bridgewater. And so in the end, do I think Nick Foles is going to wind up there? That would be my guess. That would be my sense. But I do not believe that that is done yet at all.
Okay, which leads me to another question.
Yep.
If he doesn't go to Jaguars, where do you think he goes?
Well, I think he does go there in the end. But if he doesn't, it gets very interesting because... There's not an obvious landing spot. If he doesn't go there, I mean, look, Miami is going young, so I don't think Miami's doing that.
Okay.
Washington would be the most logical, but Washington doesn't have a lot of money because the money's tied up in Alex Smith.
Right.
So, you know...
I love it when I send you into this kind of minefield.
Well, I hope that Mr. Foles gets his deal done in Jacksonville for his sake, because if he doesn't, it's going to make my mind explode, and it's going to some very interesting speculation. Yes, that too.
We're talking with Adam Schefter on the Mike Lubega podcast. More with Adam in a minute, but first, this from Geico. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Go to geico.com and 15 minutes. That's all it takes. And in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Adam, all right. Adam, we both are, in terms of New York City, we both consider ourselves local, okay? I am fascinated by the Giants' predicament and dilemma, mm-hmm. All right? And is Dwayne Haskins their heart's desire? Is there any consideration for Kyler Murray? And if those guys, if it's not them, now I'm seeing rumors that if the Cardinals go for Kyler Murray, then that puts Josh Rosen into play and maybe the Giants go for him. Take it away, Schefter.
Well, let me say this to you. I think the Giants are determined to go get a quarterback in this draft. And I think Dave Gettleman, the general manager, is about as transparent as any general manager can be. He's such a nice man that he tells the truth. He really does. Last year said Saquon Barkley is an unbelievable talent and we'd be lucky to have him. And he went out and got him. And he backed his words. And this year, he said that the perfect plan is what the Chiefs did, which is to have a veteran like Alex Smith, and the Giants have Eli Manning, and to go out and draft a quarterback. Chiefs drafted Patrick Mahomes. Giants go get one of these guys. Now, I know Dwayne Haskins seemed to light up. I had a couple of coaches walk off the set to me at the combine, and they said to me, like, he was not overly impressive during that workout.
Really?
Now, I still think he's – yeah, oh, yeah. Now, I still think he's still thought of as the first or second – universally, the first or second-ranked quarterback in this class. And I have no doubt that he's going to be, in the end, I believe, a top six pick. Top six. So I don't say that in a critical way. I'm just saying, like, I was surprised when a couple of coaches walked over and, like, didn't love what I saw from Haskins. Now, are they saying that because they want to drive down in stock? No, because it came from that have quarterbacks. But it's just interesting that, you know, there are people that raved about his workout, and then there are people who didn't. And I think that just goes to show you that beauty is always in the eye of the beholder. One thing that we've seen from the Giants that we killed so far is that they'd like to go get one of these quarterbacks in this draft. Now, I don't see Kyler Murray being that guy because Dave Gettleman's traditional kind of guy. I see him liking more of a bigger, taller, more traditional type quarterback.
Right.
So that would be Haskins, or that would be Drew Lock, or that would be Josh Rosen. Now, the interesting thing about Josh Rosen is no one knows whether he can or can't play. He had a bumpy first year, as many quarterbacks playing in that scheme for that offense, for that organization at that time would have.
Right.
But they paid him a lot of guaranteed money already. So if you trade for Josh Rosen now, I believe you get 3 years at $6 million, which is like the greatest bargain that you could ever get for a guy. And so whether you like him or not, it's worth rolling the dice just for the contract alone. The contract makes him even more attractive than he already is. And if you had a good grade on him last year, then he's even more attractive now. So that's an intriguing fit. Again, I don't know whether the Giants, I don't think it's Murray, and I think Murray probably would be going number one, though I don't think the Cardinals have made a decision. I think the Giants, in a perfect world, Haskins, Locke, I don't know how they felt about Rosen last year, but it's intriguing because of the intangibles. So, Mike, listen, I know that you're asking questions. You want a specific answer. In early March, it's tough to give an exact answer when so many things are changing.
I want to know what you think. I always want to know what you think, and which takes me to the next two guys on our imaginary Schefter Lupica board, and that is Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. Okay, because Adam, who would have thought that a year ago. With a team that thought it was set up to knock off the Patriots and go back to the Super Bowl would be it. It's not unusual to be in this predicament with one star player, but it's extremely unusual to be in different circumstances. But the circumstance basically is the same. They're both out of there.
The killer bees are being broken up.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine that neither player is going to be back, but that's the case. Neither player is going to be back in Pittsburgh. So this, they used to call the players in Dallas the triplets. So this was the modern day triplets. I mean, Brown, Bell, Roethlisberger, Big Ben. And they were really, really good. And so now it's become basically Ben, Juju, and James Conner. Like it's just very different. And look, by the time we wrap up this podcast, for all I know, Antonio Brown's going to have a new home. And right, the Steelers have told teams that they want to have a deal in place by Friday. So that's going to be imminent here, and he's going to be traded. And I know everybody keeps talking about Oakland as a team that's made a lot of noise, and it has, but I would not rule out Washington either. Washington has been in the thick of this, and it would be very Dan Snyder-like to make a move for a receiver this good, this capable, to be that kind of boost for that organization. Do I think that's the best for him? No. But the Redskins have been in the thick of it, and that would be an intriguing match.
Talking to my pal, Adam Schefter. Again, if you haven't read The Man I Never Met, go get it. It's just the most wonderful book. And he is, you know, he is the most prominent insider. Were you surprised, by the way? I got more football questions, and I'll let you put a bow on this. Were you surprised at the reaction you got? Or I wasn't surprised at the reaction, because people focus on your tweets, about how there was going to be a bigger name than Bob Kraft to come out of the massage parlor story?
I got to say, Mike, I didn't tweet anything about it.
Oh, you said it. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. My bad.
And so, I know there are distinctions and people pick it apart, and I get it. You're held to a high standard. I understand all this, okay? And this is not an excuse. I'm just telling you the facts of the day. I'm with my accountant in New York. I'm doing my taxes. I get a call. Can I come on SportsCenter to talk about because it just broke?
Wait a minute, Adam. Didn't you mean with your team of accountants? Isn't that what you meant to say?
No, you have a team. I have a solo guy that works in a closet in New York, and we were doing my taxes for 2018. Anyway, so SportsCenter comes, can you come on? Now, it's a tough thing because basically I'm going on TV, and I got a text as I'm on there from somebody down in that area. Said, hey, you need to be on the lookout for bigger names, a bigger name. Now, number one, the CEO of Citigroup is a pretty big name. The hedge fund billionaire is a pretty big name. Those in and of themselves are pretty big names. Now, I get it. All the sports writers, all the reporters, they want a bigger sports name. And we don't know who was and wasn't involved. I've still gotten texts and information about other people involved since then. Not specific names, but of certain backgrounds and titles. And again, there was no bigger name that has come to light as of this time. There may or may not be, but John Havens, you know, who ran sales and training for Morgan Stanley and was the number two, that's a pretty big name in and of itself. Like what, you know, again, there were a lot of people that made a big
But you know what
about
people
that.
Wanted to think. You know exactly, we're not even going to go down this rabbit hole, but you know what they wanted to think.
So one sentence on TV became a report when, in my mind, it was informed speculation. I mean, but I guess I'm a reporter, so I'm not allowed to say anything with any spin in it, right? Or any sort of speculative nature.
That's for guys like me. All right, listen, I promised my friend, Mr. Schefter, who was nice enough to do this today, because we're trying to make this podcast as topical as possible, that we have a limit, and if we go over it, his phone will explode. Okay, so as a guy who first made his chops, really, in this business, covering the Denver Broncos, did the Flacco signing surprise you?
Not really. I mean, first of all, there are a lot of people that have been very impressed with that guy. And I know it's a polarizing quarterback. Some people don't like him and some people do. I've had some people call me this offseason since Denver made that trade or agreed to the trade and said Denver got themselves a steal. And we'll find out whether or not it works out. He's 34 years old. He's had some injuries here. But right now, he probably was the best option for that team to win. Right now. I mean, it looked at Nick Foles. It looked at Joe Flacco. It looked at the draft class. And it felt like for a mid-round pick, it was worth casting their lot with him at this point in time. And we'll find out whether or not he does well. But Denver was aggressive for Flacco in the way that Washington was aggressive for Alex Smith, getting a deal agreed to way before the NFL new league year starts in mid-March. And again, I thought it was a good move for what they could do at this point in time. Would Joe Flacco be the end-all, be-all quarterback, the ideal quarterback that you'd build? No. But is he a good option for them at this time, considering everything else that's available? Yes, I believe he is.
Pal, thank you for doing this. I will obviously, all football fans will be following you because this is a crazy time. It is crazy town in the National Football League. As you know, not enough good things can happen in your career to suit me. The Man I Never Met. And listen, in a few weeks, I'll call it 15 Minutes with Schefty, and we'll do it again.
And listen, I look forward to getting through these few weeks. It'll be very nice and very enjoyable. And then we'll have a much more relaxed discussion at that point in time that I will greatly look forward to, Mike. I can't tell you how much.
again, thank you for joining us on what was such a fun podcast today, just because of the range of the conversation. War and Light, Tony Award winner for Best Play in 1999 with Sideman, and a showrunner for Law & Order SVU, which is about to become the longest-running network drama in the history of the business. And Adam Schefter, who has made himself the most prominent NFL inside man in the business, and a wonderful writer, too. And we'll tell you again about the book he wrote called The Man I Never Met, about the husband, first husband of his wife, Sherry. But again, these are the conversations we have. This is the fun of doing this. This is why we're doing this twice a week. So continue to download, continue to subscribe, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.